Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Thanks for tuning in to the Money Tree Podcast, your source for investing and money matters. I'm your host, Andrea Trevelyan from TakeASmartStep.com. Today, we're actually going to do something a little bit different, and we're going to answer some questions from our listeners. So with me today is our usual lineup. We've got Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds, Joe Salcihi from Stacking Benjamin, and Andrew Sather from eInvesting for Beginners. How are we all doing?
Woo! Fantastic.
Let's answer some listener questions.
Yeah, let's help people make some money. Let's go.
Let's start right in. Our first question comes from Edison. He says, hi, I have a question about investing large amounts coming from a windfall. Say you receive a large windfall inheritance, such as $1 million. Assuming it is close to 99% of your net worth, how would you go about investing this into the market, assuming you're a young person with a regular income? What are the pros and cons of investing in bulk? And are there ways around mistiming the market? The alternative of having the bulk of your money unallocated doesn't seem very attractive. So let's dive into Edison's question. The first thing I'd like each of you to answer is, how would you go about investing a lump sum? Let's start with you, Joe.
Well, I've got this one handled, Andrea, because of I actually am in the middle of this right now. I have discovered there is a prince in Kenya who's sending me about $1.5 million.
I have a prince in Kenya, too.
Mine is totally from Nigeria.
Oh, you got the wrong prince. Yours is a fake. but actually, when I would have clients that would go through this situation, which obviously didn't happen all the time, but did happen. The first thing to do actually is to do absolutely nothing. And this is the step that I want to clarify that's really should be part of Edison's question, but isn't. And that's that when you get a lump sum, you have this euphoria. You've got all these crazy things that you want to do. And so any great financial planner would tell you do absolutely nothing. Put the money in a spot where you can't get it for at least 6 months and really take some time to get over that euphoria and go back to real life. And what are you going to want to do long term? Because I'll tell you, people that do stuff with that money right away, Andrea, they never do anything good. They never
incredibly true.
Ever do anything good.
And I would actually add to that, if you've gotten the lump sum, wait. But if you got it because of a death of a loved one, I actually recommend you wait at least a year.
Yeah.
Unless you have like a dire circumstance, like a medical bill or foreclosure, you know, because it takes you that long to just get over and mourn the person properly. So what else? After you've waited, Joe, what do you do next?
Well, then I start off with the goals, right? Because I want to invest according to what my goal is. So assuming Edison said the person's young, let's say that we're saving money for, you know, an early retirement, which could be as early as tomorrow. You know, we have to look at, do we want this money to be an income stream? Do we want it to be extra money in the bank that we'll have when we're 50 or 60 years old? What's our time frame? Because once I have an idea of the time frame, then it takes this huge ball of investing possibilities. I mean, there's so many different investments out there, right? And instead of having to evaluate all these different possibilities, once I know that it's 20 years away and I need an 8% return, well, then I know which investments historically have done that. And instead of this massive field of investments I have to evaluate, now I have very few. Before, so then I start evaluating those investments, which you know are going to be completely different if it's dividends I want today versus long term returns. The other thing I do that people forget all the time is I decide which tax shelters are going to help me the most. So if it's a long term goal, especially, I want to make sure I do a good job of sheltering that money from tax as much as possible.
Excellent, Andrew. What would you do?
Oh, man. I mean, Joe covered it really well. I would just say you have to look. I mean, Edison said he's a really young guy, so you have to really kind of be humble and understand that if this isn't close to 99% of your net worth, not only is that a significant chunk, and it's, you know, losing that will do kind of this emotional damage that you might not be able to recover from as an investor. So you have to understand, especially if you're young, understand that you might not have developed the skills yet in order to become a good investor. And so I think waiting is really a great idea, not only just because you want to get over the emotions of having this large windfall, but also because, yes, if you invest it all at once, you know, you might potentially be able to get more gains, but you have to evaluate yourself as an investor and look like, am I really as talented as I think I am? And if I lose a lot of money with this, is it something that's going to really negatively affect me to where I can't recover?
Absolutely. Miranda, any other thoughts?
Well, let's all say it together now. Index funds. No, so really, I think you guys have it pretty well covered. I just think that I would probably just go about, you know, looking at the buckets. We've talked about buckets in the past and saying, well, what cash do I want now? Because, you know, really, honestly, after you've waited, I agree with the whole waiting period thing. After you've waited and thought about what would be fun to do, I think part of using that money is investing in your, you know, personal lifestyle and enjoying yourself and setting things up. So definitely take a look at, you know, short-term things that you can say, well, I want to invest in having a great life now. What can I do for the medium term? Do I want to help my kids pay for college? Do I want to buy a house? All of that kind of stuff. And really look at, here are my short-term, medium-term, and long-term goals, and chunking out the cash and doing the asset allocation so it all matches up. And then at the same time, since you do have a large lump sum, you can kind of get some of that so that it's liquid, so that the market timing doesn't matter as much, because you have your bucket set up and you have kind of that buffer.
Excellent. And I think everybody touched on kind of what I would have recommended is wait first and foremost. But then I also recommend that, you know, if you're already living on a budget and living on less than you make, and, you know, you're doing the right financial things, I would strongly consider paying off debt with some of the money. At the same time, though, if you're not living on a budget and aren't being fiscally sound, then that's the last thing you want to do, because then it's just going to kind of pile back up. And I don't remember where I read this, but it's been, you know, studied many times that when people get a lump sum, they actually end up regretting what they did with it, you know, later, because they blew it. So having a plan, writing down what you want, and kind of as Miranda was saying, lifestyle, like I would recommend writing down a list of those lifestyle things and then deciding, you know, okay, 5% is going to go towards lifestyle. Which do I want? Do I want to remodel the kitchen? Do I want a new house? And then, and kind of be smart about it, so you're not the person that, you know, blows the money. Miranda, you touched on something that is my next question for you guys. And what are your thoughts on market timing? So Miranda, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, when you've got a lump sum, you have the chance to organize your finances in a way that the market timing isn't as important. Although if you want to play around with that and you have this lump sum, I say, you know, take a little bit of it and play around a little bit, you know, speculate, gamble, whatever, if that's what, you know, if you think that would be fun. But you need to make sure you keep the bulk of it in the type of assets that aren't going to be a big deal when the market crashes. If I'm making any sense at all. But yeah, you want to make sure that you're protected against that, and market timing should not be a big part of your strategy, because most people cannot effectively time the market. It's just not going to happen, no matter how smart you think you are. It's not going to happen. And if you want to play around with it a little, see if you can, you know, increase your gains, that's fine. Take a small portion of that money and see what you can do with it. Have a little fun. But the bulk of it, personally, in my opinion, stay away from the market timing and keep it in an allocation that sort of protects you.
Joe, what are your thoughts?
I think I just want to go even stronger on what Miranda said about not market timing. When she said most people can't time the market, I'd say by most, I'd say 99.9% of people.
And that's you. That's everybody. Yeah, you're not an ex.
Yes.
You're not the unicorn.
That's right.
That's right. Well, and what's even cool about that is it even if you are the unicorn, going and thinking that you're not the unicorn is a safer way to go, right?
Yeah, true.
So, which is the problem I have every day, because I know I am the unicorn.
Oh, Joe, I'm not going there.
That took a sudden left turn.
Oh, my gosh.
All right, on to Andrew. All right, Andrew, thoughts on market timing.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second.
No, you're done. You're done. The unicorn is done.
70% of the time, roughly, the market goes up. So historically, odds are in your favor that the market is going to go up when you put the money in. So over longer periods of time, the odds are that investing it as a lump sum is the way to go. However, you got to ask yourself to steal the Dirty Harry line. Do you feel lucky? And if this is 99% of your net worth, I don't want to feel lucky. So dollar cost averaging that money into your positions is a safer way to go. Although I think you got to know going in that the probability is that you were better off putting it in all at once.
Excellent. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, that was a big reason why I did say I really agree with the whole waiting philosophy. I think just from a psychological standpoint, you have to look at the downside and the upside. So the upside of investing it all at once in a big bulk, you're going to be trying to time the market. There's no way going around that. So obviously the solution to that is trying to maybe dollar cost average and slowly accumulate whatever investments you're trying to accumulate. And so that's a really great way to mitigate the mistiming. But like Joe said, most of the time the market does go up. That 30% of when the market does go down, are you going to be able to deal with that psychological and emotional feeling of just seeing your complete net worth go in half? I mean, you take $1 million, you can quite easily invest it into some dividend paying stocks, easily average that around 3%. You'll have like an income of $30,000 a year. And if you just think about how that can compound over the years, that can make you a lot of money. If you compare that to maybe, so that's investing all at once, you could get $30,000 in interest every year. But if you compare that to the possibility of seeing another market crash and losing 50% within like a 1 or 2 year time frame, that now you're talking about losing 50%, and you're sure you miss out on the $30,000 annual income, but you potentially missed out on losing $500,000. So you have to take all that into account. And obviously, if you have a long enough time frame, that's another way to go around mistiming the market, because you know you're going to be invested anyways. But I'd really look at the upside and the downside. How much downside can I really deal with, and use that in order to figure out how risky you want to be and how much you want to dive in.
Excellent. And I would just kind of second that. I've actually done a ton of research on market timing. And typically when you're looking at a lump sum, like Joe said, the market goes up more than not. And when you look at the research studies that they've done where they've back tested everything, it's almost always better to get the money in today rather than later, unless you have a crystal ball that you can figure it out. With that said, dollar cost averaging is good, but I think that's a very different situation than lump sum investing. They're two different scenarios. So if you're very sure about what you want to do and do something like dividend investing or index investing, then I say get in. You might be at the top, but it's better to be in and earning the dividends and getting it reinvesting than letting it sit in cash and not know when that down is. If you don't know what you want to do, then you might want to consider dollar cost averaging. Take, maybe $300 or $400 a month into an index or something until you can kind of figure that out. So that's what I would do. Which actually brings us to the final question that I have that relates to Edison's question, and that is, piles of cash. So what do you think the advantages and disadvantages are of having large sums of cash sitting around waiting for you to invest? Let's start with you, Andrew.
I don't like the idea. I like to think that my money is always working for me. you know, money can work a lot harder and longer than you can. So you have to consider that if it's just sitting in cash, it's kind of wasting away. On the flip side, you know, that kind of goes against what I was talking about earlier. But I think there's a difference between having a lot of cash because you're afraid to invest and having a lot of cash from a windfall. So having cash from a windfall, I think you have to be a little bit more careful. But if you're just accumulating cash and not investing it, why not just stick it under your mattress, right? So I think it's really like a personal thing. For myself, I haven't had the fortune to have a large windfall of money yet. So for me, all my excess cash is going into investments, and that's what makes me feel good emotionally and psychologically. So everybody has to kind of evaluate how that is for themselves, and you have to be consistent too. If you're going to go all in and have all your money in investments, then when your investments tank and lose 50% in the next market crash, don't pull out and just change your strategy then and there. That's the absolute worst thing you can do. If you're invested fully, then make sure that you're in it for the long term and you're going to hold through these market bear markets and market crashes. And so that's the only way you'll be successful. You can't go one way or the other. You have to be consistent with your philosophy and really hold for the long term if you're going to go that way.
Perfect. Miranda?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with Andrew. Once you get past your waiting period with your windfall, letting it sit in cash, I mean, take out a little bit if you want a cash cushion, if you need a little bit of an emergency fund, if you feel better about having a little bit of liquidity, go ahead and put a small portion of that. But as far as even my emergency fund is invested, what I use for my long-term emergency fund is invested. So I have the only cash that I have sitting around is 3 weeks worth of expenses. And that's the only cash I have sitting around in a liquid account, is enough to get me through 3 weeks of expenses while I liquidate what is in my emergency fund, which is invested in index funds, because of course it is. So, So having the big chunk of cash there, you're losing money because of inflation. You just are. People are like, oh, well, it's risk-free. No, it's not. You have inflation risk. Get it out of your head. Everything has a risk. Everything has a downside.
Joe?
Yeah, cash is a decision I have to make later, right? I mean, if I've got money sitting in cash, I'm going to have to decide what to do with it. And I'm really bad at choosing the right time to make a move. And if there's cash sitting there, I'm always thinking about all the cool possibilities of what that cash could do. And I don't like that. If the money's in an investment, it's already working. So don't put yourself in that position to keep as little money in cash as possible.
All right. Well, I'm going to take the flip side just because there has to be a little dissent in the ranks, right?
No.
Yes.
I agree with what you guys are saying. However, I think there are a couple scenarios where cash is your friend. And the first would be is if you know nothing about investing. So, you know, let's say you've waited the 6 to 12 months and you've been working on, you know, getting through your emotions and everything like that. If you know nothing about investing and you want to invest, or you're not quite sure even about index investing, like you want to know how it works, I would rather that money sat in cash while I learned about my options than to make a bad decision. The other time that I would keep it, I kind of like cash. My husband teases me that I have an emergency fund for my emergency fund, and it's all in cash. And I don't disagree with him. So I like having that cash because it also gives me options. So when the market goes down, I can buy into what I want. Or when life hits, I don't have to worry about liquidating or anything like that. So I think having cash also opens you up to having more options. That being said, on a regular basis, we're already putting away how much we need to each month to achieve those goals. So when I have cash sitting around, it is the excess money. So
I like that. I like that, Andrea. And actually, it's funny, as you're talking, I'm thinking that I do the same thing. I just don't leave it in cash. I have it in short-term government bonds, in a short-term government bond fund. And a lot of the time, in a lot of markets, I'll even use a Ginny Mae fund. So I just worry about what Miranda says, that cash is money that's earning less than inflation. And I don't want that money sitting in cash. For some reason, if it's sitting in the Ginnie Mae fund, I think to myself, I feel like it's not in cash, so I'm not coming up with all these crazy ideas about what that could be doing in my portfolio. And nothing good in my portfolio, just, wow, that's a stock I want. I go, oh, it's in the Ginnie Mae. But if it's something that's really going to forward, you know, be help me toward my goals, then it's worth taking out of that. And just having it invested versus in cash, even though it's my opportunity spot, I prefer that.
But sometimes it's better to be in cash and deal with inflation than to make a wrong investing decision and lose 10, 15, 20%.
That's what all market funds are for.
Well, I would say too, I mean, the cash that Joe and Andrea are talking about is kind of like a smaller percentage of your net worth than the kind of cash that Edison might be talking about, where it's all of his net worth. So you have to evaluate that differently as well.
Yes. Yeah, it's the difference between, you know, excess cash. But then at that same time, I go back to, you know, Edison, if you don't know anything about investing, unless you're jumping into an index fund, don't do it until you know what you're doing. I would rather sit on cash and educate myself for 6 months than to jump into something I don't know. That's the difference between speculating and investing.
And don't jump into an index fund if you don't know anything either, because that can drop 50% just as easily. So
absolutely.
That's true.
All right. There we go, Edison. Hope that answered your question. Our next question comes from Kyle. I'm going to start with the friendly stuff that he said, because I like friendly stuff. First off, I want to let you know that I'm so glad I discovered your show and love to listen to the interesting guests you have on. As a graduate student studying finance, I enjoy your thoughtful discussions and practical approach to investing. Your show is a breath of fresh air from all of the sensationalism that covers much of the financial news.
So what was unfriendly stuff? I was going to say, what was the unfriendly stuff that he said?
No, I don't know. We haven't started getting that hate mail yet, so please don't.
Wow. We're doing something wrong.
Okay, so his question here is, in addition to being a part-time graduate student, I am a young professional, and my wife and I are saving for our first house. I would love to hear you discuss short-term investments that can be used to save for a down payment, as well as your thoughts on putting 20% down up front. I'm currently building a conservative portfolio to save for a down payment in 3 to 5 years, and I'm wondering if this is a good idea. So let's start with short-term investments for the 3 to 5 year time zone. Joe, we'll let you actually start with this, since we kind of finished on bonds and cash.
Yeah, and what's funny is part of the reason I don't use a lot of bonds right now in my portfolio, and the reason I'm not using the Ginnie Mae fund, is that everybody in the universe thinks that bonds have a day of reckoning coming fairly soon. So most of the short-term investments I might recommend in a normal economy, this is one of those few times, Andrea, that I can't do what I normally like to do, because there's just too much risk in that area with the Fed possibly probably raising interest rates sometime in the near future, although we've said that for the last 2.5 years now, right?
But they're done with the patience. They've taken the patience out.
Right. I'm getting impatient waiting for them to stop messing with the market. Anyway, let's...
And part of that already during that time, because everybody's anticipating it, part of that's already been priced into the bond market, but there's still a lot of risk there. So in this particular environment, I would say stick with, even though your interest rate's going to be rotten, your risk of losing money is so high in other places. I wouldn't go for a down payment fund anywhere other than a principal guaranteed account. So I would go to one of the you know, places online where you can look at different money market options. And I think that's about the amount of risk that I would take for the down payment.
Miranda?
Yeah, I kind of agree with Joe on that one, even though cash makes me sad. If you want immediate access to it, then that's what you do. There are options that you can do if you're planning on doing 3 to 5 years. Maybe you can kind of help boost your returns, you know, by getting a CD, putting it in a CD with a higher yield, or laddering, or looking for, as Joe said, a money market account. There are some money market accounts out there with high minimums that pay a little bit better yield. So that's something to think about. And we're just starting with the short-term investments, right? Yeah. We're not ready for my rant on, no, on buying
not,
a house.
Not right
okay.
Yet.
Okay. So,
really, I can't wait now.
Yeah. Yeah, you can. You've heard it all before. So, so yeah, I really agree with Joe on that. And just kind of look around, see if you can find an account with a high rate. There are some 5-year CDs out there where you can put in, you can get a little bit better return and protect your principal.
Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I don't have any disagreement with any of that. The idea of short-term investment and 3 to 5 years, I think the idea of short-term investments, that's an oxymoron. You really, going back to the market timing thing, if you're going to be investing in your time frames even as short as 3 to 5 years, you're really trying to time the market, and you could potentially really put yourself in a situation where you would have had the down payment, and then because the market turned, now you don't have the down payment. That's really not the place you want to be in. And for the upside that you can get, it's not really worth it. I mean, if you look at even investing in the middle of a raging bull market like 2005, 3 to 5 years from there, you would have been 2008 to 2010. So even though the market didn't turn for another 2 years, when it finally did, that 3 to 5 year time frame did not serve you well. So I think this idea that you can invest in the short term is just completely counterintuitive. I don't think it will serve you well. So like Miranda and Joe said, maybe a CD, maybe a money market, but not anything where you can risk losing money in the market.
Excellent. And I'm going to have to agree, you know, saving. I think the key word here is savings. We're not talking about an investment. You know, any time that you're going to be buying something within, you know, less than 5 years, you have to ask yourself, if the market drops by 50%, am I willing to wait another couple years for that money to return? If you're not willing to delay your purchase, then it needs to be in cash, in a money market, savings account, whatever it is. And does that lower your return? Yeah, but guess what? In 3 to 5 years, when you're done with grad school and you're ready to buy that house, your money's there. So,
absolutely.
Well, just to jump on that before we exit that also, Andrea, you know, you're talking about before having cash for opportunities. Mm-hmm. This also can't be that money market. It has to be a separate money market that's
absolutely
your house fund.
Absolutely.
I found if we don't put it in a separate fund, it ends up being used for something else.
Absolutely. Yep. I agree wholeheartedly. All right. So thoughts on 20% down. Miranda, rant away.
Well, we all know that the question I would be asking is really, do you really want to buy a house? But no, so I'm not a big fan of the 20% down. I know, sacrilege, because to me, it depends on how long you're going to be there. If you know you're going to be in the house for a long time and it's you're going to be there for the long haul, like, I mean, we're talking at least a decade, then sure, why not 20% down? I guess that makes sense. For me, though, putting 20% down into something you know you're going to move out of and that you're not sure, I mean, what if the real estate market crashes again? You lose that 20% down. So, if you're going to put money down on a house, and if buying is really what you think you want to do, then I'd say put a little bit less down, because then you're not in there. What happens? Because if you end up in a position where you have to sell and you have to sell at a loss, that 20% is gone. Whereas if you didn't put that 20% in, you could leverage. You could use that money, the extra money, if you put 5% down, 10% down, the extra money that you didn't use, you could put it towards something else. You could invest it in something that's going to have a bigger return. When you look at it, it also depends on where you're living too. Different markets have different appreciation rates, but for the vast majority of us who don't live on the coasts and who don't live in areas where homes appreciate at a rapid rate, most of us are going to be lucky to see a 2 to 3% appreciation over the long haul, 2 to 3% annualized appreciation over the long haul. And you can do better than that in the market long term. So there's a lot that goes into it, rather than just, oh, well, I'm just going to buy a home. Think about why you want to buy a home. Is it going to have a lot of long-term emotional help for you? Do you want the stability? Is it going to be more of a lifestyle thing? Because personally, I think if you are going to buy the home that you live in with a mortgage, you need to be wanting to buy that home for something other than a financial investment. It needs to be your lifestyle investment, your sentimental investment, your family investment, and an investment in those things that may not offer you a financial return. Whew. So now somebody else.
Question. I have a follow-up question for you.
My personal finance sacrilege.
Question. Don't you think that the get in with as little as possible and invest the rest is part of the reason we had the 08 collapse?
So part of the reason we had the 08 collapse, I don't think those people were investing as much as possible. I think those people were, I think most of that was creative financing so that people could afford bigger houses. A lot of that was teaser rates on loans so that they could get a bigger house and have a lower payment initially. A lot of that had nothing to do with, oh, I've got this chunk of money that I will now invest, or I will put aside for emergencies, or I will use in some other manner. Most of that crash had a lot. I mean, there were a lot of things that went into that, but from a standpoint of whatever, most of the people, I mean, they were getting 0% down loans, and most of them were just getting 0% down loans. They didn't have extra cash to invest. They weren't doing that kind of thing.
So wouldn't you actually have to be a highly disciplined person to go in with low cash in and invest the rest? Because honestly, most Americans don't have that discipline.
Oh, yeah. You'd have to be a highly disciplined person to do that. And once again, like I said, I mean, you're talking to somebody who hopes to never, ever buy a house again and who hopes to rent forever. So, I mean, come on. But yeah, so yeah, I personally think you need to first step back and say, why am I buying this house? Am I buying this house because it's a checklist on my milestone of things I'm supposed to do to be an adult? Or am I buying it because I really want it? I think you just really have to get clear on your motivations before you move forward with buying a house.
Joe, you ready to jump in?
Take me down.
I can sense that you're ready to pounce.
Actually, I'm not going to.
Okay,
yeah,
go.
Yeah, doesn't that stink? I really should have been a more fun podcast. Miranda and I just beat each other up.
I'll pounce later.
Here's the thing, though. I'm like, dude, if that's your deal, go for it. You know, it's not my deal. And here's why. But, you know, if it's your deal, go for it. Right.
Well, once again, one statement that Miranda made that I think needs to be stronger. She said, you know, if you're going to only live there a short time, think about how much you put down. That's when I think if you're only going to be there a short time, rethink buying completely.
Because, yeah, for sure.
Because when you look at the costs associated with buying a house and then the upkeep, the maintenance, the all the stuff that you're going to do in a house that you don't have to pay for when you're renting, that's all money out the window. And even though a house that you live in should never be an investment, I always like to tell clients that we need to make a good investment decision, but it's not an investment. Because we never want to be in a position where we have to move it, because the financial plan says when you reach 65, you got to move out of your house. That'd just be horrible. I think that a house is only a great investment if you're going to be I think it's never a great investment. I think it's only something to consider if you're going to be there long term. Period.
Excellent. It's hard to say that the house that you live in and bought with a mortgage is ever really, truly a financial investment.
Right.
I like to call it forced savings, because most people aren't disciplined to save. It's the one tool that basically forces you to save. But then, like Joe said, you have to turn around and sell it.
Yeah, and it drove me crazy when people said, well, my retirement investment's my house. I'm like, really? You've got all these dreams, all these things you did in your house. Like, my house has so much sentimental value to me. There's so many, even houses we rented, right? There's so much sentimental, but like, we'd leave these places that we lived and I'd remember all the memories, all the stuff. And I never, ever want to have a financial plan that says I got to move right now because that was my decision on retirement. I like my retirement decisions in terms of my money to be non-sentimental. I want to sell this index fund because it's the S&P 500. Who the hell cares?
All right, Andrew, you're kind of quiet over there.
So, I agree, disagree a little bit. I think you want to put for sure, I think you want to put as much down as you can. I think 20% is a great number to strive for. I don't know how practical it is for a lot of people. It really depends on your own personal financial situation. But I think the more you can sock away towards it, the better. It's just less money that you're paying towards the bank and interest. And I think that's a great way to go. The big thing I have about mortgages is I think having 20% is a great place to start, but I think really consider if you're going to put 20% down, are you looking at a 15-year or a 30-year? Because I made a blog post a while ago, and it was about, I called it the Deceptive American Dream Today, a $100,000 mistake. And it really resonated with a lot of people because I broke down what's the difference between the 15-year and the 30-year, and what kind of an impact does it make towards our net worth. So if you even take just the average mortgage across the whole United States, I think at the time I wrote the article, it was like $250,000, something like that. And I showed you that even though, so the difference between a 15-year and a 30-year, over the life of the loan, you're going to pay over $100,000 in interest straight to the bank. That's money you'll never see. You can never invest. It's never going to help you. It's just going straight to the bank. And so I kind of looked at the different arguments towards the 30-year, and I showed that though they're not as viable as people make them out to be. It's really like these emotional arguments that you make to justify taking out a bigger mortgage or really extending your mortgage as long as you can. Like the tax deduction, people like to talk about tax deduction. Well, yeah, it's nice to have a tax deduction, but you're not saving, like that money is going straight to the bank. It's like, I would rather pay taxes on money, but get to keep some of it. You know, would you rather pay taxes on your money and keep some of it, or just save money on taxes, but it all goes to the bank? So I think that's really a big thing. You have to decide. I think Miranda really put it nicely, you know, decide, is this something you're doing just to check off the to-do list, or is it something you really honestly and genuinely want? And you have to understand that this decision makes a huge impact on how your net worth looks like for many decades along your life. So don't jump into something just because you feel like you have to do it, and really understand if we're going to try to do it, I would say for myself, get a mortgage that is as small as possible and try to pay as little interest to the bank as you can. And I think that's really a great way to kind of maximize your net worth situation in the long term.
Yeah. I want to second that, because I didn't answer the 20% question. If you are going to get a mortgage and if you think it's a great long-term investment, avoid PMI at the very least. And I like the idea of a lot of money down. If you're going to do it, you know.
And that's, I'm going to kind of, I agree with bits and pieces of everybody's. I am definitely a 20% down girl all the time. PMI to me is a wasted expense. So buy the house that you can save the 20% for. So you can save that additional money. It reduces your interest. But another thing to keep in mind is with the new qualifying regulations and all the new stuff that's been put into place since the market downturn, it is really hard to qualify for a loan, especially the smaller your down payment is. If you're, you know, trying to take out a 90% loan to value, banks are not as nice as they used to be. So it'll make it easier to qualify. I agree wholeheartedly. You need to make sure that you're in this for the long haul, because the costs of buying, selling, and maintaining a house just don't make it feasible if you're not going to be there at least 5 years. You got to know your market. The one thing that I would disagree with, Miranda, is...
Oh, I'm sure there's plenty to disagree with.
Is, you know, even if you're going to lose money, if you put down less, the bank is going to come after you for a short sale. It's going to be on your record. Personally, I guess, and I've lost money on houses, I would rather take that cash hit and not have to deal with a short sale and a hit to my credit.
But here's the
to lose that cash. personally. You can't turn around and get another house, assuming you want another house.
Well, here's the thing, though. So the way I'm thinking from my own personal experience was if we had put 20% down on our house and then we ended up selling, which we did, and when we had to sell when the home was worth less than we paid, if we had put 20% down, we would have lost that 20% down. Plus, on top of that, the amount of money we had to pay to make it happen. We still had to take a cash hit because we did not go the short sale route. Right. We didn't want that short sale. So we paid the cash that we needed to make that sale happen and make the difference. And so we did. And so if we had paid the 20% down, we would have had even more on top of what we paid to make it happen anyway, because we would have lost that 20% down plus the amount that the house had depreciated. Does that make sense?
It does. But I think it goes back to kind of what Joe had said, is houses are not a good investment.
Oh, no,
period.
No.
And when
I bought it, I knew it wasn't. We were just hoping it wasn't going to cost us quite so much to get rid of it. So,
well, you definitely have to look at it as a lifestyle. You have to know your risks.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Like you know your risks when you buy a dividend stock, and have to be willing to accept those risks. And life will throw you curveballs that you weren't thinking about. So, yeah. Let's move on. We have one more question that we're going to tackle today.
Only one more.
And I will say with this one, I'm going to read the question, but then we all kind of agreed on the main point. So I might just nominate one person to go over them and then we can chime in if there's extra. So Scott says, as a Canadian investor, what are the top three significant factors that will impact my net gains when buying or selling outside of Canada? So Joe, do you want to talk about the three that we had discussed earlier?
What did I do? Draw the short straw?
You did.
Magic.
Well, you know how I hate to talk.
You haven't bought me a margarita in a while, so you're it.
Yeah, then we get really chatty. And this is a good question because it's not just for Canadian investors, but anybody buying a foreign stock has to worry about a few things. The first thing is that stock market can go up, but because of the exchange rate change, you could actually lose money. And I've seen that happen to people before, where a stock looks like a great company. Fundamentally, they're doing everything great in their particular economy in that country. Things are going well, but because the relation between that currency and the dollar, if you're in the U.S. or the Canadian dollar in this case, gets wacky and goes the opposite way, you can lose money. So number one is you have to worry about exchange rates. Number two is the tax bill. People are often surprised when they have foreign investments that they end up with a foreign tax bill. So that can be a big issue. And then the third thing is just how we are usually better investors when it comes to investments that are in our backyard. We hear more about them. We're more likely to stay on top of them. Something happening across the world, it's much more difficult for me to know what the pulse is of action happening on the ground where that company is. So my ability to get information about that company is less. And you got to be aware of the fact that you might miss some important developments because it's a foreign stock. And I think those are probably the three biggest.
Excellent. Anybody else want to chime in on what they think?
I'll just jump in too and say that you have to be careful which market you're looking at too. Like some of the other markets, like China, is a big one that's jumping out of my head. They're not as heavily regulated as the companies in the United States. So you have not only the risk of the investment going down, you have the risk of these accounting people and executives lying to the general public. And so if you're in the U.S., don't take it for granted that we have the SEC and we have the GAAP, the generally accepted accounting principles. Those things are in place to mitigate fraud and minimize it. And some of those things might not be as heavily regulated and looked at in other countries. So consider that as well.
That's a great one, Andrew. I didn't think about market manipulation also. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Miranda, anything?
Nope.
Excellent. Me neither. All right, guys. We have officially finished our first question and answer episode. So I want to thank everybody for joining us today. If you have questions that you would like answered, come on over to our site, moneytreepodcast.com. Drop us your question. We will try and do another show like this. Also, if you enjoy our show, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a rating and review over on iTunes. With more reviews, we can be found by more people. So till next time, have a wonderful week and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.